All right, so we'll go on record. This is the July meeting of the Clark County Parks Advisory Board. We'll start today with a roll call and then move into a couple other administrative items. I'll start with me. I'm Jay Chester, Parks Advisory Board co-chair.
Kevin Tyler, Clark County Parks.
Caught him with his mouth full, almost.
You did that on purpose.
Of course.
John Spencer, Clark County Parks. I forgot the whole tag. You should put that out there.
Stacy Kaiser, Parks Advisory Board.
Parks Advisory Board. I said that wrong. Put myself on the staff.
Margaret Anderson, Parks Advisory Board.
Dave Weston, PAL.
Dallin Redford, Parks Foundation.
Kelly Putney, Parks Advisory Board.
Megan says she's here. We'll leave it at that. All right. The meeting minutes were attached from June. Does everybody have a chance to look at that? Do I have a motion to accept? It's a short meeting. We only have 2 hours.
I'll move to accept the meeting minutes for July.
Second.
Second? All right. It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? All right. We remind all the PAB members and all volunteers to submit their hours to either the website or the forms are right here that you can do. Fill out and submit, and Megan or somebody will get it. We'll get it to the staff. So please make sure you do that. I am terrible about it, so I will. I'm part of reminding myself to do that. All right. So that brings us to our public comment period, and I want to remind everybody we have, I guess, revised public comment guidelines, and we give you an opportunity to speak up in the first part of the meeting, and then after the meeting, after all this content goes through, you have a second opportunity to come up afterwards if something caught your eye or you have a question about something that was presented at the meeting. So we're trying to move through our agenda quickly so that we don't get pigeonholed or anything else into a sidebar discussion in the middle of the meeting. So, and we also, the PAB members will stick around after the meeting. If you want to have further discussions, we can do that. Or most of us can do that. Some of us have kiddos to get, but I guess school's not in session right now, so we'll go through that. So, did we have anybody we check?
Okay. Please keep it to 3 minutes.
And yeah, please keep it to 3 minutes.
Okay.
That's a requirement.
Perfect. So, are you Dan Brown?
Yeah.
Okay, come on up here.
And then Katie will be right after.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Jana Brown. I'm a property owner here in Clark County, a horse owner here in Clark County, a member of the Clark County Executive Horse Council. I was on the Humane Society Board for 6 years, so I'm involved in a lot of animal rescue, horse rescue, but my primary reason today for being here has to do with Daybreak Park, and our group, the Executive Horse Council, has adopted the park as far as cleaning trails, making horse trails available for equestrians to use that park, and I know that there's a long-range plan for facilities. My directions aren't so good, but to the right side of that picture, and then you guys can refer to the picture, there would be the horse facilities hopefully going in, and then, of course, the loop horse trail. And I'm just here as an interested party in that, knowing that it's going to be another hidden gem for folks to use for their horses and trail riding in a beautiful country setting that goes along with our culture and our history here in Clark County, and kind of mirrors what they're doing there at Whipple Creek, which I believe has really been a gem for you guys as well. So I'm just going to continue to follow it and be involved as as need be for that. And we do volunteer hours there as well. So thank you.
Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, I'm Katie Kennedy. Likewise, I'm also an equestrian. I'm here because I'm interested in the Daybreak development with the equestrian trails, and it's exciting to see the map up there. As Jana said, we have adopted the park. We've been going out there doing some cleanup efforts. It's a pretty clean park, so it's been easy. But one of the things that came up, I'm not asking a question, I'm just letting you know that one of the discussions that came up was about a location for a manure bin, if we were to build something for that. And I don't, where would we put, you know, needs to be where the trailers would be so people would clean it up. And of course, my understanding with Whipple as well is that then we have to have a system for collecting it and taking it away as well. But where would be a good place? So that's the reason I wanted to make a comment, that we had had that discussion, came to no resolution, but I did want to let you know that we talked about that.
Who did you have that conversation with?
So Jelaine Barros is sort of the head of the adoption group, and Anita Will was there, and I think it was Anita who brought it up, that's an important thing that we have to manage as part of that, and probably one of the first steps, if people are going to show up with horses, we need to make sure that we have a way to do that, to keep it clean. So that was really the discussion about where would that be.
I think we should continue that discussion, and so our volunteer coordinator recently left, so once we fill that position, I think that would be a good time to pick that back up.
Any idea, time frame, few months?
I'm going to say 2 months.
Okay, just a ballpark is good. Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, anything else? Anybody else? Sorry. Okay, so we'll move on to item 4, unfinished business. Park Standards Subcommittee, the update. Kelsey's not here today. We've been having a meeting before this meeting, the hour before this meeting, to further discuss the development of park standards. Purpose of that meeting, our PROS plan comes up in 2021, I believe, for renewal. We're trying to work with several entities and inside ourselves to come up with, to update that. That'll start and open up in early 2020 to have the discussion, come out to the public. So in other words, we're trying to get a little bit of a head start on that and try to get our park standards further refined. And as things develop, urban areas develop, you get different definitions, you get different types of parks. We're trying to expand our definition of parks, if you will. It's our first agenda item is what is a park. So we're trying to get that type of standards, elements of the parks, what we'd like to see. So anybody else want to comment on that? That's the update, if you will.
I think the big thing that's a change is we are looking at the trail part of the system a little differently. So that's probably the focus on the lot.
Okay. And it is one of our items.
And I think the other thing is just a lot of discussion around credit system for park impact fees and how we develop that, and being really careful and considerate in the way that we do develop a credit system and how that's going to impact the PROS plan.
Right, because a lot of this was brought up by the development community being so active nowadays. We want to try to create a scenario, standards, where all of us feel like we're getting a little bit out of it, out of the development. Okay, PAB deed work session, the counselors. So we had a work session in front of the county counselors with Deeb. We went there. Deeb was represented by Eric Guillermo, and Kelsey and myself were there. Barbara was there. John was there. Kevin was there, obviously. And Laura, who's in the back there. We presented what we had developed with DEEB, and that presentation showed items that we had agreed on as far as development of parks and credits, items we didn't agree on, their side and our side. The presentation went fine. There was some, I'll call nuances, little things that were stated and said that we were surprised by. Some of them were a backtrack, if I can use that word, on some of the from the development community, and we realized, or I realized, that the counselors all have a different thought or opinion on public, what's public, how does it account for it. The biggest thing was, you know, we're, our standards, we're trying to hit a 60% performance level of service for our parks, and they wanted a further, they, counselors wanted a further definition of that. I think there was some confusion on what is a park, why is it per thousand and how, citizens, why is it this, why is it that. I don't know, Barbara, you were there. John, you want to add to the meeting or what your thoughts were?
Thank you for that. Well, encapsulated.
Okay. Subsequent to that, I'll update everybody. We've had a couple meetings because one of the things we realize is that there's two things. One is the counselors are not as familiar with the PROS plan as we are. So there was some misconceptions. Kevin did a great job of summarizing some things and the performance criteria in there. You know, X number of acres per thousand. We're behind on this. We're behind on that. And the counselors were not in agreement of the calculation, if you will, how to rate the system. So one of the things I came away with is we need to educate each other to get a common understanding, if you will, about what needs to be done. And subsequently, Kelsey and I had a meeting with Counselor Blum. We gave him a PROS plan that he had not seen before. And he was very honest about it. He's, you know, they've got so many documents they see, so many things that come by their desk. He says, I've heard the PROS plan, but I had not seen it. I believe that's probably common for all but probably maybe one of the counselors that I know of. So, and I think subsequently we sent a PROS plan copy to Counselor Quirin.
Yes, she requested one and I provided her with a hard copy.
She requested one, which was great.
Counselor Quirin.
I didn't hear.
Council acquiring requested a copy of the PROS plan.
Temple's very familiar with it.
Right, and that's why I said one of them I'm fairly sure was familiar with the PROS plan. So anyway, we met with Council Blum. He was very informative, and he admitted that the counselors need to be educated, needed to come up to speed, if you will, on this kind of information, because he didn't realize one of the questions was, why do we measure our level of performance via, you know, per thousand acres per thousand inhabitants? Why don't we use our own criteria? And so there was several discussions, and Laura Hogarth put together a book that I wish I kept, actually, because it has all the kind of cheat sheets, all the kind of information on why. And a simple answer to that question is, because the state and the national, when you go after grants, they have to have some common way to measure your performance against all other states or all other counties, whoever's competing for those grants. So that was the common measurement. The Clark County didn't come up with this by our, you know, sitting around and talking to our consultant, and they said, oh, this is one way to do it. And we said, okay, that's a great way to do it. It's a common industry standard, if you will. I hate to use an engineering term, but and I'm an engineer, by the way, so that's where some of those come out. So anyway, I feel like we have a little bit of a task in front of us to educate the counselors and to try to help get the counselors to the point where they understand why we're coming from where we are, what was going on. They brought up several good points. You know, again, working with the development community, they develop parks, they develop what they call pocket parks in their communities, and when we, and our PROS plan doesn't acknowledge that at this time. So part of our subcommittee discussion and going forward is we need to figure out a way to acknowledge those parks because they are a park. They are open to citizens to be used. Now, how it's used and how it's open is another part of that.
Give us an example on that. I don't recall.
Well, they felt like, the counselors felt like that if you have a pocket park in a neighborhood and it's even owned by an HOA, those neighbors, those people that inhabit that neighborhood should, you know, they're citizens of Clark County, inhabitants of Clark County, that should go into the calculation. And our rebuttal to that was, it's not open to the public. John Q., who's living in the north part of the county, undeveloped, even if he or she or the family drove to that park, they were not going to be allowed to go in because it was owned by an HOA. So it's limited to who can use that, and we have to be equal and fair to all of Clark County's inhabitants, so our citizens. So that's kind of the little bit of a discussion we got into, and it's a little bit of a too finite a discussion for that scenario, so we need to come back and educate. Yeah, I think we need to come back and educate and work with. But we were heartened by several of the counselors did contact us afterwards and said, obviously you guys have got some information that we don't know about, so we need to work through that. And so that's what I think is our challenge from there. I don't know, John, you, Barbara, you guys were there. Anything else that you...
I think I would just add, there's particularly a couple of counselors really were sympathetic to developers wanting to count those private parks as parks.
Right.
And that in particular is something we are going to have to really focus in on finding a way to compromise.
Well, and part of that, just so everybody understands, the translation of that is those pocket parks, they would like to get credit, partial credit, off of their PIF fees for that, the development community. And the challenge with that is, number one, PIF fees are for acquisition and development of parks, and we have several park areas that aren't developed yet. So if we start giving away credits and reducing the amount of fees we get in, then there's a challenge to go ahead and develop the parks that we've already promised to do through there. So that's one of the challenges there. I think the other challenge was, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but the development community would like to see the level of service get raised up or the calculation change so it can raise up so the PIF fees can be reduced. And that's something that we've waited 13 years to get the PIF fees increased or back to where we feel like they're normal. How it was implemented was up to the counselors, and it was implemented in a little more aggressive manner than we thought they would. And so therefore, you know, that was the kind of the backtracking, I'll call it, as I characterize it, in that the development community wanted to see the PIF fees either reduced or changed in some way, shape, or form. And we just, that's not something we want to move forward. And we want to move forward by educating everybody and in agreement and joining with D, not backtracking and going through rehashing stuff that's already passed.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So if you don't provide credits to the development community, does it provide a disincentive for them to put in little pocket parks?
I don't know. I can't speak for the development community, but I do know that they use the pocket parks to enhance the value of their property.
Right.
And usually that's maintained by the HOA. If it's a private one, it's maintained by the HOA.
I think in a lot of cases, though, they're required by code. Those types of park elements.
Some of them are,
they're required.
Not the pocket, the smaller ones. Or not.
Well, I think it depends, but I mean...
Well, it depends is an easy...
It depends if they go through PUD or mixed use.
Right. Yeah,
so,
right.
I mean, it's an option. It does not give them any reason to make it public. That is something that's certain. I mean, they're not gaining anything by making it public.
Right. Right.
So that is the definite.
What is the purpose of the signs a liability issue? Is that what, because if the HOAs own these and then someone from the public outside of the development comes in and uses the park and gets hurt, then
is that what the signs are there for? I'm just wondering.
Well, I'm not an attorney. I don't know.
I just mean ours, because our HOA, I have to say, has been extremely aggressive in protecting our park. And
I've been
very little of it had to do with my
ability.
They fenced it in, and there's a keypad now to get in.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they do.
Oh, really?
They talked about doing that even with our little park.
Part of its maintenance.
What it has to do with is the statement, and we've heard this from homeowners many times when I sat on the board there. We paid for it. We don't want them in there. It's as simple as
more
that.
More use is, you know, yeah, you're...
Well, I call it the piggy approach, because whenever I was there, the one exclusion there was in our neighborhood was that if you were invited as a guest of a member, so I didn't care if I knew you were or not, if you came over and you were playing there, and our little lady with the clipboard came to find out who you were, I said, oh, that's my neighbor friend from across the way, because I think children should be there playing. But no, they very aggressively, in some cases, not every HOA is that way, but I can say that I was very surprised at some of the comments that residents made, and not one of them brought up liability as an issue.
So going forward, we hope to continue to work and plan to continue to work with the development community and developing the park standards. And because, again, when we come to the 2021 and we present our PROS plan and the updated version of it, we would like to have, you know, all jurisdictions that are involved in parks and the community development that are in agreement that this is, you know, maybe not exactly what everybody wants, but it's what everybody can live with, and it's quite frankly the best for the county residents. So that's where we want to go.
Yeah, I think following that work session, some things that popped into my head and after discussions is absolutely it's about education and it's about speaking the same language. So when you say industry standards, we need to present the council and development engineering advisory board with, you know, what are the industry standards? Do all of the local jurisdictions out there count pocket parks that are in private developments and school district properties, or do they not? If nobody does, then we're going to be the same as everybody else, right? Same thing with park impact fees. We should put it up there on a slide and show them, here's Clark County's park impact fee, here's everybody else's in the region. Where do we stack up? Are we outrageous, or are we kind of right in the middle? I have a feeling we're right in the middle. Actually, we might be kind of lower.
We're probably a little lower.
Yeah. So those are the types of things that we need to make sure that council understands. Present them with the information and then let them make their decisions. We'll move forward with the next PROS plan. Right. I think we can do a work session with them to kick it off.
Right. Did I hear you say that the developers did a little backpedaling from our discussions with them?
Well, when we had
that's
our
a problem.
That's kind of the problem is we don't. Yes, that is what happened. In my mind, they backtracked when they said we'd like to see the PIF fees reduced or changed, and that we had that discussion in our subcommittee. Just so everybody understands, the development community and PAB created a subcommittee to work together to come up with this presentation, and we had that discussion and explained why why the PIF fees don't need to change right at the moment. I mean, you know, they'll change as we go forward, but the development community wanted to change the method of calculation so that the PIF fees would be lowered. Again, going back to, you know, because their drive is for affordable housing. Somehow I'm not sure how the PIF fees are tipping the scale on affordable housing, but you know, we all want affordable housing, and I believe the Parks Advisory Board and County Parks will give their fair share of toward affordable housing. But if everybody else is willing to do that, we'll work through it. So, but that's what I meant by backtracking is that there was a change in that type of deal. Because
was it the same people we negotiated with?
Yes, it was the same people.
That was different people.
It just was a statement
that
was
side,
made.
Yes. with those comments that we were unprepared, and I was not happy with that because we negotiated with them in a sense of fair play, and we certainly didn't go in with anything deviant from
discussions. No.
And for that to occur was disappointing.
Yeah, my bigger disappointment, quite honestly, was the fact that the counselors wanted to and thought that we should include more facilities or more park areas, if you will, private and public, in the calculation. And that just, if we do that, then we reduce our opportunities to get grants. We reduce our opportunities to you know, go out and get more money and more development. So
it would be deceptive because those don't really meet the criteria. Hence, they're not meeting the people's needs.
Right.
And as such, I think that we need to stand firm on it.
Well, and we need to go back and again, you know, I think Kevin said it right. Get everybody on a common understanding of definitions and calculations and how they're all used.
Do the counselors understand, like what Barbara just explained, that happens in her neighborhood? These homeowners are pretty, you know, pretty territorial when it comes to their HOA parks, and if the public isn't using them, I don't understand how they could.
So yeah, I think they do understand. I believe that they do understand that. I think from their point of view, if a development builds a park facility within and it serves
their taxpayers,
it serves the people in that subdivision, right? And so it doesn't meet the need of everybody within a half mile of that. So it may allow some people to play at the park, but not everybody within a half mile. So I think they're thinking there should be some credit given for that.
They're looking at it like this. It's 1 acre or whatever per 1,000. Well, if we take 100 people out of that 1,000 of need, then it equates. That's what
then we have 0.9 of an acre left,
right,
that we need to meet. Right.
That's where they're going, I think, with that.
And to that, there is some credit.
I understand.
Oh, sure. And we're in agreement that there should be some credit.
What that is.
Just create some type of guidelines.
We base everything on that half mile radius. And when you put something here and then everyone else outside of that, it no longer has a need for that half mile. Where in reality, we're going to be building two parks right next to each other to cover a half mile.
Right. And that doesn't make, it's not practical. Okay. Anything else? All right. The Whipple Creek Restoration Committee. This may be kind of combined into item D, but we had the Whipple Creek Restoration Committee here last month, right? At the last meeting. And they offered to give us a tour if we would like to come and tour the facility. And I think a lot of us would like to do that. And that segues into, during the summertime, the last couple of summers, we as a group, the PAB, have taken some tours, annual or monthly tours of facilities that are around if a new park was acquired or the development of a park is ongoing. So my question to the board is, do we want to do that again? And if so, what day or afternoon may work best for everybody? And
Do you have some ideas of what you would like to tour?
And I think the first one would be Whipple Creek. That's how I segued that in there.
Well, I think that as long as I've lived here in as many parks as I've gone to, I continue to learn at every one of those tours. So I do think that they add value for us and help continue our education. So my vote is we go for them.
My vote's yes, too.
I would say, obviously, Whipple Creek, I think Daybreak is going to be coming back around a couple times. We should probably go and visit.
Probably
get
a look at
well.
That. Yes. Okay. An afternoon. We've done it before on Friday afternoons.
Is that the same time as this? So Friday afternoons.
Okay. Is that with everybody? Let's see. Today's the 12th. Can we do the 26th? Kevin, would that be?
I will be on vacation.
Okay.
But if you want to do the tour with somebody else.
You got anybody else?
I was going to say, do you have anybody else?
That would be the
calendar.
Let's see.
Are you on vacation the 19th, which is next Friday? I don't know if that's too soon for everybody, but
I can't do the 19th.
I'll be out of town.
I would reserve that just because it's budget season and I'm up to my eyeballs in spreadsheets.
Okay, how about August 2nd? Would that work for everybody?
That works for me.
That works.
Okay, let's shoot for August 2nd, noon. We'll go to Whipple Creek and Daybreak. How about that?
You're going to do both of them in one day?
I'm not sure the distance between the two.
Pretty decent drive between the two, but not terrible.
Well, yeah, Daybreak's the battle ground.
You're already kind of up north at Whipple Creek, so you hit 179th and head over.
Depending on how long the Whipple Creek presentation or the tour would be, I think we could do that and then go over to Daybreak.
At 2 o'clock in the afternoon instead? Does that just not work for most people?
Well, that's a great idea. What time would we start? That's a good question.
I mean, because if you're going to be all the way out there, it's a long trek back down into here. Me, I live out there, so later in the afternoon the better, because then I just go home. Well, it's a long, it is.
No, that's fine. I totally understand. Do we want to do August 2nd? You want to do noon, 2 o'clock? What time do we want to start?
I'm hoping all afternoon.
What's
that?
One?
Meet in the middle at 1.
Yeah, we can do that.
Meet where?
All right, so let's anticipate.
Well, because we have things going on
between the 2 o'clock.
Understand?
That kind of in the middle. Yeah.
So we'll try to do that August. We'll do it. Okay, so we'll schedule a tour August 2nd, Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock. And we'll work with you and Megan, you'll be.
If
I have backup.
You have backup, okay.
If it turns out that
you won't be joining us, yes.
If it turns out it's just too far to go, we ought to just focus on some of the other things around that area.
Absolutely.
So we really hit the west side.
Sure.
And, and maybe
if there's another property on the west side.
I haven't been over to Salida for a while.
Make it easier, and then we could do Daybreak in
another
in the next day in September or something.
Yeah, the weather's still good in September. Yeah.
So anyway, I think we owe it to the west side to do a good job.
In the parking lot?
I think we'll probably, let's anticipate meeting in the parking lot at the
So we're going to be at Whipple?
Yeah, we'll go to Whipple.
What about if we can find out that Ridgefield trail that we keep talking about?
Mm-hmm. Oh, the park down there?
That park that goes down.
Okay.
That's close. I'd love to see it. Yeah.
We could swing actually through the new sports complex at the same time.
Good opportunity to connect with the Ridgefield Parks Board as well.
Where do we meet for the parks?
Towards 700, the parking.
Public Works over there.
Oh, right.
The public. Oh, here or over at the.
Oh, okay.
Where do we go? You put together in the
city. It's across from.
It's 4700.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay.
That'd
be
super. Public Works. Oh, okay. So then we just carpool,
and then it's just
we'll get a van. Feel like you want to drive separate, just because you're going to leave.
No, if we're going to go that side, no. And I'd be back to work anyway, so that would be perfect.
Yeah, we'll arrange for a van.
Okay. If you were driving out to Daybreak, I'd probably just drive.
No, I mean, we'll
stay out there. No, that works perfect.
Okay, Megan will get out an agenda for us and an invite for the PAB. And then, so that's all for unfinished business. New business, we have Columbia Cascade group here, so I don't know how you want to present this, Chris. So.
I have a PowerPoint on a jump drive, if I can quickly. Yeah, I don't know.
For some reason, we have a preponderance of people that like to bang up their feet and It's room kind of today.
What's going on here?
It's that season.
I guess so. Yeah, Kelly's got his knee all banged up. Ankle. Well, you got a cast on that one.
Yeah, I got a full cast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
almost good at these crutches now.
Almost.
You're good at it about the time they catch up the cast and you don't need them anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where those knees are easier.
Yeah, you know, I've gotten that recommendation and I'm really starting to think about it.
Yeah, when your arms start getting so sore.
Ah, there.
So, first thing.
So, why don't I just kind of open this up, because the conversation started a few months ago with the play equipment and the creativeness of it and what a local company has provided us over the years. Chris's dad and grandfather have been running the company for the last 35, 40, is it 40 years now? I think it is.
Close to 50.
Yeah, close to 50 years. They have their manufacturing plant down in Fruit Valley and hire a number of people, but Chris is here to tell us the story. So I'm happy to have you here, and I'm really glad that you can get a PowerPoint up here for us.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me to come speak to y'all today. Let me pass these down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a few extras here in the back. And then we'll watch them.
Do you have any more, Chris?
Yeah.
How many do you need? Oh,
these are cool. So, as Kelly mentioned, I'm Chris Kern with Columbia Cascade Company. I've been making playgrounds here for 50 years. We've had the pleasure of doing quite a few in Clark County over the years. But we ship this stuff all over the world. That was actually a playground we just finished up in Central Park in New York City. As part of being around for as long as we have, we've had the opportunity to do some inclusive playgrounds as well. And so that's what I'm here to talk to you all today. So to start the conversation about an inclusive playgrounds, I thought it would be helpful to start sort of where it began. So we started with wheelchair accessibility. So in 1990, when we passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, we ended up needing to start adapting playground equipment to be wheelchair accessible. And it took the industry a really long time. We actually didn't get our first set of playground-specific ADA regulations until 2000, so we had a whole decade of developing these pieces of equipment. So on the left is a transfer platform. And what that allows is for a wheelchair user to roll up next to it, use the provided handrails, and transfer themselves over onto the structure. And then the one on the right is going to look a lot more familiar. It's a wheelchair accessible ramp. So in the context of inclusive play, it's a good start, but as everybody in this room knows, disabilities come in a whole lot more forms than just wheelchair. So, really nice. So the goal of an inclusive playground is to go beyond that bare minimum that the law requires for ADA accessibility, and we want to make this playground accessible to players of all abilities. So that includes typically developed kids. It includes children with developmental disability, visual impairment, hearing loss, in addition to wheelchair users that are currently accommodated, we want to get everybody. And the other big component of inclusive play is, in addition to providing these opportunities, we want children to play together. We want all of the children with varying ability to be able to use the equipment to cooperate with one another. We want to use equipment that facilitates players interacting with one another and developing better as a result. So, to accomplish inclusive play areas, to start with, we need to have a variety of equipment that's going to meet the needs of anybody who's going to come to the park to use the playground. So we end up with all sorts of sensory equipment, with equipment that promotes cooperation and socializing. And we also want to make sure that the equipment that we're providing is providing enough engagement and enough stimulation. Part of the reason that playgrounds are so good for a child's development is that they challenge. Children, grow on a playground cognitively and physically. So we want to make sure that those challenges are still there. Moving into more of the physical side of inclusive play, we want to make sure that if we have a larger, more traditional type of structure, we want to make sure that we have lots of points that we can enter and exit the playgrounds. We also want to make sure that there is adequate spacing between all of the different components, especially ones that are separated from the main play area. And this line, deconstructed playground equipment, this is kind of a more modern trend that play area development is moving into. Instead of having one large structure, we end up with more smaller clusters of more ground level activity. And sort of what that does is it moves away from the traditional idea behind ADA, which is we need to get children from here up onto a structure. Instead, we can just bring the structure down towards ground level and make it more accessible. And then probably at least the most interesting one to me personally is we want to be able to provide both high and low traffic areas on a playground. Because children require different levels of stimulation. They can only tolerate so much. It's especially important with children who have autism. That's a pretty big component of a play area. So we want to make sure that they have areas where they can go to and feel safe and be just be away from the hustle and bustle of the rest of the playground. So, in order to accomplish this, I've broken this into a few categories, but this is sort of the first component, sensory equipment. Sensory equipment is really important to inclusive play. So we've got a couple images here. We can start on the left with we call it a Cosmo panel. And what that is it actually, it has marbles that are sort of sandwiched between two panels. And as a child runs their hand across, they all turn and move and provides that tactile feedback. That's stimulating. Up to the right, it's actually a set of water tables. That's at the playground at Columbia Tech Center out east. Those are also fantastic because you have children that they can hear the water, they can play with it. It also promotes cooperation. You need a child that's going to be pumping the water while, for everybody else downstream. And then this guy below, he's got a chain chime, which is sort of a piece of musical equipment to provide that auditory sensual experience. As they turn that wheel,
is actually the metallic components that sort of take down the chains and create noise that way. And then there's a tic-tac-toe panel as well on the back side of all of those. There's going to be X's, and I'm sure you've seen those around at playgrounds here in Clark County. They're nothing new, but I included them. We actually did playgrounds for both the Washington State School for the Deaf and for the Blind. And when we did the school for the blind, they said, we really want to incorporate those because they have the yellow on black, they're high contrast. Mm-hmm. Even a child with limited, you know, visual senses can use this. Also, those shapes are actually in relief in the plastic. So they can run up, they can put their hands on, they can feel that it's an O or an X, even if they have no sight at all. So the next big section that's also really important to building an inclusive play area is that we want to have equipment that's going to facilitate children of all abilities to cooperate with one another and to play with one another. If you can imagine a scenario at a typical play area where a typically developed child, you know, maybe isn't gonna be that facilitation there if there's a disabled child also playing in the play area. They may not play with each other at all. And so part of an inclusive play area is we want to make sure that they have the opportunity to cooperate. So this first item on the upper left is a nest swing. And it's a newer item that several manufacturers, ourselves included, are starting to roll out. And it's a cooperative piece of equipment. You put 3, 4, you know, sometimes 5 kids in this nest, and they gotta figure out how to make it move. So, you know, if you're familiar with a normal swing, it just doesn't work the same way. Same thing goes with a hammock down below. That's also at that Columbia Tech Center playground. A very similar idea. These tubes, these gray tubes up top, those are actually talk tubes. And those are connected underground. And it's amazing how far travels, or sound will travel on a pipe. We can put those 100 feet away from each other. And kids just light up when they can see, you know, they can see they're talking to their friend way on the other side of the playground. They absolutely love it. But it's something that's easily accessible. It's low to the ground. Anybody, it doesn't matter if you have 2 children with mobility impairments on either side. It really doesn't matter at all. They can cooperate and talk to each other that way. And then we touched on music as a sensory type of play experience, but it's also really good for cooperation. So we've got these 2 guys jamming over here on the drum set, and we have 2 players here with a metallophone. And if you put those 2 together, you put those 4 kids together, now you have an ensemble, and they're gonna, you know, play music together. That's the idea. And really quick, up on the top, there's a set of ship's wheels, one up on a deck, on a traditional post and deck structure, and one down below that's going to allow for even somebody who can't get up on top of the deck to participate and steer along. So the third type of equipment facilitates these low traffic areas of the playgrounds that I was referencing before. So if we go to the next slide, we have equipment that just gives children a space to be, to hang out, to observe. Up on top we have a nest of a boy, and I believe that's his mom in the photo. An area where they can just sit down and feel enclosed and feel safe. Same thing goes with a tunnel crawl. You can see
see if she's hanging out in there, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if, you know, they just stayed and hung out. We also, as part of a lot of the structures that we saw, we include a kid's bench. So it's just a seat that sits underneath the deck. But I mean, if you visit any playground, you'll see kids playing underneath the deck. And even though there isn't, it's not enclosed in any way, they still feel a sense, they have a roof over their head. They still feel this sense of enclosed and safety. So we give them a space underneath to allow that to happen. And that's kind of the same story with a play frame, a teepee over to the right, where it's not enclosed, but it's just an area of interest that's off to the side that a child that feels like they've been, you know, they're overstimulated, or they just don't want to be a part of the high energy areas of the playground. They can just go there and contemplate and observe and hang out. So we can open it up for questions if anybody has them.
So my first question is, wouldn't it just be cheaper to give them all iPads?
Fire.
Ask Ridley.
You're not going to make friends around here,
sir. Early on, you mentioned hearing loss as one of the inclusive items. How does that impact kids on a playground?
You know, personally, I don't have a good answer for that. I have not worked on a playground that specifically caters to that. I think it makes it a little more difficult to provide that cooperative effort. And communication is an issue, and I think that an inclusive play area is still going to give them something that they can enjoy doing even by themselves, so that they can still stay engaged with the play area, even if they're unable to communicate.
And since nobody else is bringing stuff up, my other question is, when you were talking about the progressive challenges, and I want to expand those because I want to get back on the playground myself more. Is there an effort or a way to progressively challenge up into the teenage years without endangering the 6-year-old?
It's difficult. It's difficult.
Yes, it can be done.
Good. How?
Well, there's other countries such as Japan, for example, that is doing a lot in terms of looking at play and the development of the total person, mind, body, spirit, and expanding it through different types of equipment and looking at how it might be used by, for example, preschooler as opposed to a child in elementary school as opposed to a child in adolescent or in the middle.
I would love to see. Yeah, exactly. I would love to see some examples of that.
And the play equipment really is developing all atypically as well as the non-typical developing child. So that is every child who uses the equipment would be gaining skills.
Yeah.
Or refining skills.
With something like a musical instrument or something like a set of water tables, there's going to be something there for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a 10-year-old typically developed child, you know, you can stand there at the water table and have just as much fun as maybe a 6-year-old with autism. The idea is that we want to have something there that everybody can use, but also is fun and exciting. You know, we want every kid who pulls up to the park parking lot, we want them to can't wait to get out of the car because the park is so much fun. We want that experience to be there for everybody.
Side note: we were talking in our pre-meeting about park definitions, and this should really be part of the park definitions.
Yeah. I was going to say, there's a pocket park by our house, and we've lived there for a very long time, so my kids were babies there, and now they're 20, in their 20s. But I remember thinking as I was taking the kids down the street, and they were 4 and 5 and 6, it was great, but the sign really says, not for children over, I don't know, 8 years old or something like that, and I thought, you know, why would they do that? Because the kids wanted to go and play on the equipment just as much as the little kids did, even when they got older. So I was just wondering that same thing about, are they thinking about adding those kinds of standards into parks so that they're not limited to just little kids? Because my kids would have played on them. They did anyway, realistically, especially if there weren't any other kids around. They went and played on them anyway, but it would have been nice for the park to have something that was a little bigger, a little more difficult, and there was plenty of room there, so I was kind of surprised that they didn't add things like that.
They did. Yeah, that's adding the pictures. If you've been here earlier, I gave some pictures out from our little pocket park, and we have replaced these little horses and chipmunks, these little animals on the strings, several times because the teenagers go right on them and they break them.
Yeah, because they're too heavy.
Because of the weight constraints. Mm-hmm. But you're right, we need to have more for teenagers.
Yeah.
But that's a challenging question. And I think it's a good one that you brought up. Because I run that through my mind all the time. How do we engage these teenagers in a positive way in our parks?
Well, sometimes just hanging out in a spot like
exactly.
The chair underneath the structure is as good a thing as you
especially
can have for teenagers.
Table there that they can write on.
Well, that's where I see these little tiny basketball areas that we put in are so positive, but
well,
that limits it to the kids that are good at basketball.
Yeah, no kidding, which mine aren't. But even realistically, you know, if her little one down at the park, they're going to want to sit on those things as well. So they need to be sturdy enough for, well, you know, a teenager at 14 can be taller than we are by a long way. So
some of the kids in Ridley's class are bigger than you.
Hey, Chris, not to break this up, but Chris, can you give us a little bit of information about your company? How many employees you have down here at the plant? And do you know that information? Or?
Yeah. So we've been operating a factory in Vancouver. Like Kelly said, it's just at the southern end of Fruit Valley, right where it's Fort Plant, basically. We've been there for over 40 years. I think in the very, very beginning we were in Portland, and that moved over pretty quickly into Vancouver. We're headquartered in Portland, but all of our manufacturing facilities are on this side of the river. So we employ about 60, 65 people, and it's split probably 60-40 towards the factory side, so there's more employees there than at our main office.
But you guys also do different amenities.
We do.
Park benches, garbage cans, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I toured your plant years ago.
Oh, yeah, nice. I noticed, as I was walking up the parking lot, those are actually benches that we made here. We do quite a few other items as well.
How do we engage you guys as vendors? I mean, do you have design capabilities, or how does that work? Would somebody give you a blank piece of paper, or do they give you a park and say, what would you recommend here? How does that work?
So one of the things that makes us unique as a company is that we're set up to do custom work. So if you came to me and said, I want something like this that does this, you know, we can make something like that happen. We have a team of designers who are, you know, who can make something in CAD and make it. Basically, our factory is one giant custom fabrication shop. We have all sorts of machinery to make whatever you need. But realistically, if somebody is planning a park, generally they have a theme in mind. So, you know, I want to design an inclusive playground. I want to design a nature playground. You know, I'm building a pocket park. You know, I need something that I can make and just have it be done. It kind of depends on what the goal is and how we would approach it, but we can do all sorts of things.
What type of customers do you have? In other words, is it, do you usually work for public parks or cities that are building a park, or I would think you don't have too many private clients, but maybe you do. I don't know.
Yeah. So all of the equipment that we make is commercial grade. It's for public use. So predominantly, yes, the end users of our products are cities, counties, government agencies. We do also do quite a bit of work with developers. So folks that are building a pocket park up in Ridgefield, we work with them quite a bit as well.
So the timber forms are really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I read your description about how they're preserved and free of hardwood and that kind of thing. What's the life expectancy of a wood structure compared with metal structures?
A wood structure can last a really long time if it's taken care of.
Okay.
It does need a little bit more work than a metal structure will. But we have a playground in Central Park in New York. It's got probably 1,000 kids on it every day. It's been there since 1989.
Okay.
Yeah, it can last 20, 25 years if it has the right kind of maintenance.
And then the other question is, and this I think speaks to more of the teenage and older crowd, is the concept of American Ninja Warrior and these things it's really popular, right? So have you guys started to explore into the realm of extreme climbing types of apparatus?
We really haven't, but I think mostly it's because nobody's really approached us with the intent of doing that. I'd be interested to try to make something like that. But typically, our playground equipment age range is going to be up to about 12 years old. So beyond that, we don't have a whole lot of experience, but it'd be fun to do.
So thinking budgets and various space constraints and all that, is there a ranking of any sort to inclusivity features? Is having a surface more important than having a tactile area versus the other?
There's definitely nothing formal. It's still new enough, I think, that's still being figured out. At least determining what works well in practice. I think it's going to come down to the preference of the planner, really. Surfacing is really expensive, especially if you want to do something board in place. Depending on the needs of the individual part, I think it makes sense to look at it that way.
Have you seen any examples of the surfacing, new technologies that are eventually going to get that price to come down a little bit?
I'm not really a surfacing expert, but I really haven't. I'm not sure.
We worked with them when we were doing the Waterfront Renaissance project, and they designed for us a bench, garbage can, planter boxes, the whole family of design that you'll see on the waterfront. I know that when we asked them to do that, we thought we needed our own bench based on the Portland bench that you see all over Portland, which they had done prior to our bench. And so we like to think of the bench that you call it a
Craftsman
bench. We call it the Vancouver bench. But you'll see that Craftsman bench in cities all over the country. And it was was funded. But the point is, they do cast iron, they do steel, they do wood, they do... You were about the first to really do powder coat painting in this region that I know. So that when you paint the equipment, it's powder coated and lasts forever. So if you ever have an interest, you said you went down and saw the tour of the plant. It's fascinating what they do and how many different things they can do. I don't know where you do your... where you get your plastic, basically. I don't know if you do.
It's actually local.
Is it local, too?
I think it's a Richfield.
But it is good to know that right here in this little town, we have create things that you'll see all over the world. And I've seen them in China, or not China, in Japan. I've seen them in New York City. I've seen them in Madison, Wisconsin, and just all over the world.
And just to put it out there, should you ever need a space to demonstrate products, we'd be more than happy to.
They did build a...
Good job.
They did put a nice little playground down at Fruit Valley right on Mill Plain. You see it right there when you come off the bridge. It's a nice place. And what is your last big project here? Was it...
For the county, it was Otto Brown.
Otto Brown.
And you mentioned, you visited the factory. Open invitation. Anybody who'd like to come? Welcome to Lisa.
Do we have contact
summer tours? Yeah, no kidding. Well, you could do a winter tour because that's probably inside.
Yeah, make it the longest one of the year.
Actually, a lot of it's outside. In warehouse buildings where you're kind of in and out walking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'd be nice to do it. In the summertime, it's nice to do it in the morning. It gets kind of hot up there.
Yeah. Okay. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
A lot of sweet again.
A lot of wet?
A lot. Yes. A lot of.
Chris is actually the one that had designed the rainbow arches for the All Abilities play area. First one in Clark County that hopefully is going to be built pretty soon. But it took us 10 years to get to this point. But then also, he is much more user friendly than some of the outlying places as well. But for example, with the Cooper Creek Woods Park that was saved. He has the timber form types of design, but that's exactly what we were proposing for that particular park. And there's also when you were asking about the hearing loss, the vibration of the drums is what we really wanted in our area, so that's what we had on our price too. So thank you very much, Chris, for doing that. And it's been a pleasure working.
Great. Okay.
Thanks. All right. We'll move on to under new business, Lower Daybreak 30% concept plan.
All right. Sarah.
Ah.
Hello. I'm Sarah Smith. I'm with Clark County Public Works. And project manager for the Lower Daybreak Park Trails Improvement Project.
Can I get you to speak up just a little bit?
Yeah.
It's probably not your nature, but
yeah.
You've got a couple of interested folks behind you.
Okay.
You've got you oriented the wrong way.
I can stand up.
If you want to come on up here, that's great.
I'm going to help project. Most of you might know where this location is, but it is located northwest of Battleground, kind of in between Battleground and the center. And it's a quarter of Northeast 259th Street and 82nd Avenue across from the existing Daybreak Park. And this kind of just shows the local roads in the area that can get you to there, and also the site that's in relation to the existing park. And I went out and visited there on a nice sunny day, and I got some pictures of where the proposed location is for the future trailhead off of the existing Daybreak Park boat launch parking lot. And this is just looking back at the parking lot, and you can see that there's already some worn paths, so people are already using it. And I saw people out there. And then this is the concept plan for 30% design. It's where we're at right now. Also kind of just shows the proposed sections of the trails that we have. Some of the goals of the master plan, when I was given this project, there was a master plan that started being developed in 2008, and it was completed in 2010. And reading through that, some of the goals of the larger master plan was to maintain the site's rural natural character and to support environmental stewardship and also accommodate passive and active recreational uses. And then with this project, we need to meet grant requirements and obviously be within budget and schedule.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Sure.
So on this map, so what's the, because the type is so small, so what's the pink and what's the blue?
So the pink is a proposed horse trail. The blue park is, blue is a paved, this is a paved trail. And then, looks like it's the same color, but this is a gravel trail, loop trail.
And the pink rectangle is the equestrian area?
The pink rectangle is just kind of drawing your eye to where it's connecting to the
park.
Where
was
the equestrian?
There's an equestrian area, is there not? Or am I getting my parts confused?
The pink is equestrian.
Yeah, there was an arena and stuff originally.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
South corner or something like that? Yes.
South and east of the pink trail.
Yeah, okay. Probably
south over here. Yeah, all right. So that's future
facing? Yeah. This trail development project is not even considered phase one.
No.
We just got a grant for a trail, and that's what we're building.
Both trails, the paved and the equestrian.
The paved. Yes, the grant is to pay for the paved service trail, which includes over,
go ahead. Just going to go over the features. I'll be talking about the trails, the overlook, an area we call a turnaround, an access path, and the trailhead. Just kind of a high-level view. So we're still a pretty early stage of design. So this is the main trail. It'll be about 10 feet wide, and it's measured about half a mile long. It connects directly to the overlook and the turnaround. There's also proposal for it to be pervious to meet some stormwater requirements. And then the gravel loop trail is 4 feet wide, a third of a mile. That's the path that you see that's over on the west end that has the loop, basically, gets you back to the main trail. And then as you're moving west from the trailhead, you will first encounter the overlook. And this is a concept of the overlook. The master plan notes that the East Fork of Lewis River has kind of a cobblestone shoreline. And so as a design guide, this was utilized. So you can see there's cobblestone detail on the seating wall and inlaid into the concrete. And then also, this is where the loop trail comes back in, the gravel trail, and then the main trail will continue on to the west. So when you reach the furthest west point, you'll reach the turnaround. This mimics the overlook in that it has similar design themes. With the concrete joint work. There are also, I didn't mention it before, but there would be interpretive signage in this area be a path that will get folks down to the Eastport Lewis River. That'll be similar. I think it's about 4 feet wide path. There is some, we're talking about maybe having kind of a staging area up the top as people get down to the water, just so that people can meet each other as they're going, accessing the river. And then the trailhead connects to the boat launch parking lot, and it will be an accessible trailhead at the main trail. And for schedule, we're planning to construct summer of 2020. And this was funded by a grant from the Washington State Recreation and Conservation Office. And we also have a website up that has more information. The grant was an aquatic land enhancement account grant. And we're also in process of planning an open house for people to get in the neighborhood and in the wider area to visit and get information about this project. So if there's any questions, sure.
No impacts to the boat launch?
No impacts to the boat launch.
Perfect.
I think for the sake of us, it would be good to have the comprehensive or the master plan first, and then we see how this gets over the top of that, so we know what we planned, because those master plans are still a master plan for us.
Right.
That's all. Just it could help.
Sure. It is linked to on the website, so you can view it there. So.
But I don't remember it right now.
I know.
Here.
Well, it's a really big document.
Yeah.
I think the trail, and maybe Pat can speak to this too, but the trail is a component of the master plan.
Right.
One component of the master plan.
Yes.
And the grant that we submitted to the state was to just
I'm just saying for our background, it would help us to have that master plan showing up here to start the presentation.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean the trail location is very similar to the concept shown in the master plan.
Yeah.
Now the master plan, because it deals with the entire site, which is about 100 acres, has a lot more components.
Right.
Unfortunately, the grant is only $500,000 for development, and that doesn't go very far these days. So we are very constrained budget-wise, and that's why we're hoping to get some public use amenities out there, hopefully build some enthusiasm for moving forward with more components of the master plan, probably using refunds if we can and other grants.
I don't know how many of this group was here when we did the master plan. That's the only reason I think it's helpful for us to have that document to see how it fits in.
Sure. You can certainly get it there.
Yeah.
Megan, do you have internet access right now? You don't. Otherwise, I would say we could bring it over now.
So of the 100-ish acres, how much is this opening up or giving access to, do you know?
I'm not sure. The site is 106, but we want people, there's a lot of environmental constraints out there. We want to maintain people on the trails,
okay,
away from wetlands and habitat. There's quite a bit of a permit process that we have to go through even for this.
So it's really since opening up, it's the trail.
Yes,
the trail is the
trail,
focus.
Yeah.
Okay.
People can see the nice, they'll get a good view of the nice areas. Yeah. And then also really good views and resting points of the overlook and the turnaround to see up and down the Eastport Lewis River.
A lot of this area has already been used.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know that it's opening up much.
Questions?
Thank you.
Okay, so the next item is the park impact fee update, and I saw that in our packet.
Of course.
Anything anything to note, Kevin, that jumps out to you?
So what it shows is the balances of at the end of May and the balance at the end of June. And then below that, you can see how much it's grown in that time period. So I think, you know, some highlights are districts 5, 6, and 8 have grown pretty substantially in the last month. So they're on that. And district 8, is it district 8 is where we have, I think it's where we have Curtin Creek coming up. Or maybe that's District 6, right?
Yeah.
District 9 hasn't grown a lot. That's where we have Cozy Camp coming up in the near future. And I believe Salmon Creek Community Club is also in that district.
I thought Cozy Creek was in 10.
Is it in 10?
It shows it's 10. 10. 10. Yeah.
Oh, it's down below.
Yeah.
I can look at that and then know what I'm talking about. Pleasant Valley is in District 8, so that's coming up in the near future as well for development. So I think we'll be a little bit constrained in District 10, but as the 179th Street comes online, you'll start to see that grow substantially.
Now you got in 5, you've got Otto Brown still being developed.
Constructed.
It's done, right?
It's done. Yeah. It was finished in 18.
And then in Dogwood was done in 14?
Yeah.
Okay. No, well, it says parks constructed.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good reminder of what we've done in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So one thing that I will provide you with some additional information on here very soon. If you remember at the last meeting, Monica Tuberville was here. And she mentioned that there were no restrictions in RCW about past balances in acquisition funding versus what we have in combined acquisition and development funds. They have essentially collapsed all of their PIF districts and funds. And they're
into three.
And they don't have any limitations on how they spend that money. So she sent me a bunch of information, which I have not digested yet, but I just wanted to mention it to you, and I will then make sure that you get it.
Appreciate it.
Before the next meeting. So she did follow through on that request, and I'll be getting that to you here shortly.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Where I was going to. Okay.
Any questions on park impact fees? I think we
don't have any concurrency coming up.
We didn't have any concurrency anytime soon. And so we are proposing to use some park impact fees for the Hawkinson Park Disc Golf Course project, for Cozy Camp, for Phillida, and the Children's Garden and the parking lot expansion, and Curtin Creek as well. All those four projects are in the next year or 2 years.
The Children's Garden at where?
Phillida Park.
Phillida Park.
The one that Melotta mentioned just a few minutes ago.
Okay. All right. That wraps up for new business. Manager's report and routine business.
Yes.
I had no idea we had different types of business.
So let's start with, in your packet, and on the screen, we have here what's called the Grace off-leash area. And if you want to open the one that's Mark Phelps Properties. That's that one. Okay, so Mark Phelps came to former manager Bill Gehrke a year or more ago to talk about these two properties. He lives on the property to the south. It's about 5.5 plus or minus acres. And he also owns the one to the north, which is about the same size. And and he is interested in donating the northern property to the county in hopes of developing the county developing it as a dog park. And then I met with his with Mark and his attorney earlier this week, and they also suggested the possibility that, you know, if that were the case, as he were to grow older and pass away, eventually he would, in his will, donate the other property to the county, so that the county would gain a total of 10, almost, well, probably about 11 acres. So if you notice the red dot on the county outline up there, it's in North Clark County. That is Gable Road. So can you go to the map? Yes, that one. So the little light blue square in the middle is where his properties are located. So it's pretty far removed from any urban development. And so I know Bill had worked with him to identify what potentially a dog park could look like, and that's what the Grace Off-Leash area map shows. Bill did those drawings. Pretty simple development. You have a parking lot, probably gravel, a light, a drinking fountain. The property will be fenced, and then people can take their dogs there. Is there a need for a dog park in North Clark County? I don't know the answer to that question. I haven't personally spoken with Dog Paw to see if they'd be interested in partnering. Some of our staff suggested that Bill had talked with Dog Paw and they weren't particularly interested, but I don't know the answer to that question. I have to follow up with their new executive director right now. So I wanted to throw it out to you as a group and see if there is interest. County's growing rapidly, but is it growing that rapidly?
No, I'm just thinking of PIF 10, for example. 25 years ago, they would have said no, and now we've got no land.
Right.
So I always think when land is offered, it never hurts to take it as long as it's not a maintenance burden.
Right.
Part of it is to develop it as a dog park and maintain it.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
That's so, my concern.
So that's So the discussion that we had with the attorney was that the purchase and sale agreement could include language such that the county would have a certain period of time in order to develop it as a dog park, and if we didn't, then
like 20 years.
Yeah, that's kind of
what's the
he's the I think he's thinking right. of less than five.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does it all have to be dog park, or can a portion be?
I don't know. That'd be a good question.
5 acres is a lot.
It's a nice dog park.
Yeah.
But it's a long way down.
It is a long way.
Well, and the other thing is you'd have to brush out a lot of this area. I mean, there's trees and dogs like trees, I guess, but all the other dog parks I've seen are pretty cleared off.
And his vision of the dog park is that it's more of a natural dog park. So he likes the idea of the wooded.
So he really wants it. I just don't know
parking lot.
There.
Yeah, but I after the last year and a half of Dog Paw and us and all the rigmarole we've gone through with that, unless Dog Paw is really willing to sign up for this, I don't. It's a concern. I agree with you totally. If somebody's willing to let us have land, we need to seriously look at it. But
preserve
if it's a dedicated use or
well,
know,
I just see
like
in
that.
20 years when urban sprawl has gotten out there,
then
we'll say, why didn't we get it?
Right.
If there's any way to do it wherein we're not forced to spend a chunk of money in the next few years, then.
Well, I wonder, it's outside of any park impact fee boundaries.
Yeah.
So where does the money come from?
Yeah.
It's either general fund or real estate excise tax.
What if we talk to the Humane Society on this one?
You don't think so?
No, that could be something.
The property.
We'd have to, we would have to go in with a dog partner.
Yeah, that's why I say the humane society might just be the right mix for that.
And maybe if you keep it natural enough, the maintenance wouldn't be that bad.
But he also expressed an interest in some sort of a, and I don't know if we can get there legally, but we could explore it, a volunteer park host type of situation where he would perform some of the maintenance in exchange for what, I don't know, maybe his utilities.
Does he have dogs?
Yeah, he has a dog.
A dog.
It just would be nice to have the freedom in future years of the county work to to develop it as more than just
a dog park. Yeah.
As a 10-acre property out there, and as the center grows and Battle Ground grows, it could be a good property 20 years from now.
20 years from now. Yeah.
Well, I think that would be probably the approach to him is keep talking to him. But I mean, again, if he wants something to happen imminently within the next 5 years, then we'd have to partner with somebody.
Yeah.
And again, where we get the funds to purchase this property. Because like you said, it's outside the 5th district,
right.
So that goes into
if he
donates it, that's a different thing.
Developing the infrastructure and the maintenance would be, those are two
concerns. It's a long drive out there.
It is a long drive out there.
Okay. What else?
So the next one on the list is another property. And this is owned by Robert Sewell. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And there are a couple of individuals here in the audience that could help answer any questions. But it's a 5-acre property in the Pleasant Valley area, about a third of a mile south of Pleasant Valley Community Park, and a third of a mile north of Greyhawk. So it almost fits into that within a walkable half mile. I haven't personally spoken with Mr. Sewell, but the folks that are here are talking with him, and I believe he talked with our former parks manager. This is where a lot of this information came from, was in Bill's files.
We've seen this.
So you have seen this. Okay, good.
Yeah.
So I guess there was some discussion about the possibility of us buying it in the past. It sounds like donation may be an option. And I'm looking at you guys to make sure that you have a nod in their heads. The one concern that was raised has to do with transportation routes. And if you look at the map, there's a dead end on either side. You can go back to the aerial photo, that's good.
Now I remember.
There's a dead end road on either side of the property. And I know that Bill had some discussions with our transportation manager at the time, and that if you were to develop the property, a developer would be required to build a road through there and make those connections for cross circulation. To develop a park on that property, would we be required in the same fashion? And the answers that we've heard so far are yes, we would have to, but I would want to confirm that with, is there any way to do a road modification to get out of those requirements?
I feel like we've gotten out of this before.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, about how we don't want a road running right through a park.
Well, I think in
a safety issue for children.
In other jurisdictions, like City of Richfield, City of Battleground, they'll take a trail in lieu of roads.
Yeah, I mean, these are local streets. This isn't major circulation here.
No,
yeah, it's not. There is the 600 feet rule that the county deals with. What's a 600 foot?
For roads.
Just intersections based on block intersections. But any large school or any
right, yeah, you've got all sorts of examples.
So,
right. Yeah.
So I feel like at least there's a discussion that we need to have with the transportation group and development engineering who would be approving this. Is there any way to road modification.
Well, I'd explore the multimodal type scenario where it's not a vehicle, it could be bikeway, it could be trail, it could be anything but a car.
We have other parks that we've done this exact same thing on. Yeah. We have dead end streets locked off with trails going through.
But we've also had one where we had to build it. Like, Covington was one where we had to build the connection through the back quarter of the park.
But this is residential streets. This is not, and you're not going to serve development on either side of this.
I think that's our next stop, is to see what they say, and then once we know what they're saying.
Yeah, so one, is there interest from you as a board to continue the conversations?
I think we're fine.
Is there wetlands on the side, or is it just the aerial that makes it look like a drainage?
That I don't know.
No wetlands.
No wetlands? Okay.
Is Mr. Smule intending to live there, or are those...
He's not resident. He's in the county of Peru. He's just Cabanian County. Okay. So he's asked the homeowners association around the development to be his advocate. And he's pretty dead set on trying to keep this as an existing property intact as long as he can.
Nice.
Are there renters?
No. He does maintain it very well, though.
Okay.
I talked to the transportation group. See what they say and see what they would require us to do.
I feel like Bill had talked to them last time we discussed this. Yeah. And I felt like they said we needed to connect, so I'm curious to see where you get.
That's the message I heard, too, but I don't know if he talked. So there's the transportation division, which determines transportation routes in the county. And then there's the development engineering group that reviews and approves subdivisions and other development. So I don't know if he talked to them.
Okay.
Because there are methods, like, as you know, road modifications that can get you out of engineering requirements. And so if the argument could be made, there's a way to meet one of the criteria of road modification, then there's a way to get out of it. So we just have to explore that.
Laura?
It sounds like we have some advocates for this property. Would it help you in that conversation if they were able to put something in writing in support of this becoming a park and not transportation circulation or development? Would that help your conversation?
I don't know if it would help the conversation, because the code is the code, and you have to meet certain criteria in the code in order to get a modification to the standards. So,
but we do have to.
Until
have
we know what the standards are and what the criteria are, then I think maybe that's where the conversation comes in after that.
Okay. I was one of the staff members that went out there with Bill and Jeremy.
Okay.
And it's a beautiful property.
Yeah.
It would just make it a beautiful park.
Okay.
It's grown so much that it's really served a lot of
people. Yeah, it looks like it,
Okay. Well, I will set up a meeting with development engineering and report back to you likely in a month.
So I would suggest we put a little bit of a spin that we are very interested in knowing we can make this work. Rather than just
how to make
what do you tell us?
Yeah. How can we make it work?
Yeah, help us find a solution.
Yeah.
Is there any need for input when you go to have this initial meeting? Sort of an input about what the neighbors might think if they made a thoroughfare through there?
So that
because
might
there would be a lot of pushback.
Yeah, I'm sure there would
totally
be.
Totally apart from the park.
Yeah.
They decided to connect those two dead ends. They would be cutting through basically two neighborhoods, pretty much brand new, pretty much $500,000 homes.
Yeah.
Well, when I'm looking at this from a bigger scale, I see circulation heading all the way north to whatever that is up there where they have
134th Street.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
that's
131st.
See, I think
there's lots of circulation there.
Yeah, it looks like a private driveway all the way down.
I think
I'd have to look at the transportation plan. I think 134th is
from that town, so
one of the major east-west connectors identified in the like 20-year vision. So
it is.
That, potentially, there's a argument to make the connection on the extreme north end of the property, but that
I don't know. I can see that. Yeah.
I would object to it because I live in my backyard. That's right up against this property.
Okay.
The problem we have with all the development off of Northeast 50th is they're using Northeast 131st as a thoroughfare.
Yeah.
And they're speeding, you know, anyone is putting their life in their hands crossing the street, and there's no sidewalks, there's no speed bumps, there's no crosswalks, even for kids who are coming from one area to cross the street to catch the bus. If they connected a road there, it would be a very unsafe situation.
So, I mean, I think that's some of the information that we would want to include in our discussion.
Well, at this point, I think if we just show an interest in the property.
Yeah, and it,
we just need to find out what they want.
Yeah.
And ask them how to make
just
it work as a park.
Well, yeah. Gosh, we could do it.
And if they push a road, are they going to take responsibility for any liability for someone getting injured or killed?
No.
That won't work.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't answer that question.
All right. What else do you have?
Okay, so what else? Yeah, so Pam Bonneville, you guys have asked, can we see the request for qualifications? And so sort of the direction that I've been given is to use the county's, well, so we use the MRSC roster. MRSC stands for Municipal Research
Services
Consortium. And so they maintain a list of consulting firms for architectural and engineering and other professional consulting services. So I've been asked to use that list to select five consultants and provide them with seed money, about $20,000, to prepare high-level conceptual plans for what Camp Bonneville could look like if we were to develop it as a regional park. So this document is my beginning point for that. It gives a little bit of project background. It gives a scope of work and some desired qualifications. And so my goal then is to have selected off of that MRSC roster a list of consulting firms based on do they have qualifications like parks and recreation master planning and parks development and things of that nature. So with that list, I will provide them with this document and ask them to respond to the scope of work and provide their qualifications. And then we will go through a process to evaluate and rank those and then select five and enter into small contracts with them. So that's kind of the direction. If you have any input on this document and the desired qualifications or the scope of work, I would really appreciate it. And I'm trying to get it out soon. Like I mentioned, it's budget season.
If you're having more fun than you can stand.
That's right. So let me know. It doesn't have to be now. You can shoot me an email on the side.
What is your schedule, or do you have one?
I don't know.
How long does it typically take? If they get awarded a contract, how long does it typically take for them to develop it?
Develop something that? Like that? 60 days.
I'm sorry?
60 yeah. days, possibly. We'll probably give them a couple months to work on it.
Is there a reason you're going with five firms? That seems pretty high, especially when you're given $20,000 to work with.
That's just the, you know, I don't, that's the number I was given.
typically
is that
our director.
So is that, that's a budget of $100,000?
Yeah, and that money's coming out of the Camp Bonneville Timber Fund.
But those are trees that are okay. Well, I just questioned the five, maybe three would be a better approach. I know that it's got to be more than two.
Yeah. And so to give you guys an update on the advisory board, or the, we called it a community working group. We had asked for members from Parks Advisory Board to sit on that, and we asked the council to adopt or appoint a working group for Camp Bonneville.
Right.
And they decided, they elected not to at this point establish that council or that
working group. Okay, it wasn't
working. Okay. They've, so what I've heard from council is just taking a knee on it, to speak less eloquently, I guess. Taking a timeout and looking at Camp Bonneville from the 30,000 foot level, slowly and strategically, about what we do on that property. Because A, it's a general fund site. It's outside of any metropolitan park district. It's a huge property. And there's a lot that could be done out there, but it's also very expensive. So I think the council wants to just make sure we do this thing very carefully.
You know, one thing,
and there's no reason to rush.
But don't we have federal allocation and the ability, as I recall, to go back and reassess at this point?
That would be.
And the longer we draw that out before we go back and say, hey, the millions that you gave us wasn't adequate. And from our tour last year, I seem to recall him encouraging us to reassess soon.
And who was that?
Who was the guy that did the tour for us?
Jerry Barnett.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he said that we got a federal dollar pool.
Yeah. Yeah.
When we took that over, that was supposed to be used to clean up, but that they had very rapidly found and had to go back and ask them to reallocate more, that there's a lot more munitions out there than what they anticipated.
Right. And that's what they did. So we're up to 70 or 80 million spent on cleanup.
Yeah.
So wow. To date.
Yeah. So,
and
so
another, I mean, it's not done yet. So, it'll, so the idea
but
is.
But the delays you're talking about don't impact that cleanup effort.
No, not at all.
Because he said that that needs to move forward very rapidly, so that they, if they exhaust that pot, they are still within. What was the time frame you told us?
Don't remember.
This is just their master planning, though. The cleanup's continuing.
Cleanup continues.
Okay, this is
separate,
only for the
separate
master issue. Plan
only
after the cleanup is finished.
Correct.
Okay, correct. Misunderstood you.
Right. Should there be a transportation component to this? Because that's one of the big issues is the streets out there.
Yeah, and you know,
and
I think
part of the concept plan would be the transportation.
I think the idea behind the transportation system is that we don't know what we're building out there until we do. Then, and what kind of a demand people are going to come?
That's
when you find.
And that's actually a key thing that this doesn't say, is include demand projections. That would be a really good thing.
Is 20,000 to be enough for these firms to
so
develop?
This is a new concept for me, because the idea is, through the development of these conceptual plans, we would then select a firm to do the formal master planning, which when you do the formal master plan, you would get into the transportation systems, the projections for demand, the, and that would be a larger, more comprehensive,
but you get to
more
use,
expensive.
They're essentially buying a proposal.
Yeah.
Buying a proposal.
You're buying a conceptual idea.
But they're asking for sophisticated drawings.
I know.
Right.
I don't know what that is.
So normally, and maybe you can speak to this because you work for a consulting firm, is when you have to bid on a project, you put a substantial amount of
we time. Eat a lot of money.
You do. And so if someone were to give you money to put in towards a proposal, then you would match that with what you would already put into a proposal, and then you put that. that much more effort into your conceptual proposal. That's the idea.
That's the theory.
You'll find out real quick if it works.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you'll also find out if you do have five firms that want to do that. It may not be five firms. It may be
we may not get five responses.
Yeah, you may not get five responses. You want to get three or two.
Yeah.
You know. Well, a nice thing, too, you know, having several proposals is you go back through and read through them. If you say, well, this is 90% what I want, but these other five have a few other things that we'd like to add
you
to.
You paid for it.
We already own that.
You already own it, and it's nice to have some of that extra input because different people have different ideas. So having some extra.
Are you adjusting, if you only get, say, three proposals, are you adjusting that amount?
And 20,000 isn't in stone either. It might be 15 somewhere in that ballpark.
I was kind of wondering if you were to just ask for three and up that a little bit, that you might get a better product. I don't know.
Three is fairly standard.
And you're going off your list of approved that you've already selected, right? Which you had like five on there.
So we're going off a list that, so if you go into the MRSC roster, you plug in different categories of what you're interested in, and then it generates a list.
Qualified.
So, qualification. So the list has about 15 or 20 on it, and then I'll notify all of them.
And you're stuck with
them. And then whoever responds is who will evaluate.
So it's not the five that you guys selected last year or whatever.
Okay.
What else?
What else do you have? Yeah.
Oh, I think you guys asked for an update on the parks director or parks manager
process
right. Hiring. So it was, I think, advertised for recruitment in mid-May. An early review was scheduled for June 3rd. Our director said recently that he wanted the deputy director that he was hiring to be involved in that process of hiring the parks manager. Since that time, the person that he attempted to hire has backed out of the deputy director position, and so he mentioned he may move up the timeline for hiring the parks manager. So that's what I know right now. There's no timeline for that schedule. No one really scheduled that. So we're still waiting to hear.
The position is closed. The application.
I believe it's still open.
Oh, is it? Okay.
So. And then other vacancies, we hired Jeremy Knuth's replacement for our resource management coordinator is the name of the position. His name is Grant DeJong. And he will be starting on July 22nd.
Okay.
And as you guys know, Karen Malone left Clement County. So we're going to be recruiting for her position here shortly.
All right.
Any questions for me?
Okay. So we'll move to we'll move to our second part of the public comment. We have, let me see, Linda would like to speak.
I would just like to say I'd like to support Robert's property being turned into a park with no road access through it, but that in the development of the park that the people who will be users of the park have input into its development and looking at ideas that are used in other parts of the United States as well as the world and making it accessible for not only very young children but also people who are aging because there's a lot of us that are aging.
Okay. Dr. Malata?
I just would like to say, speaking about the
knee. You guys
come on up here, Friday, if you can, please.
I
have a busted knee.
Okay. Again, otherwise. The legs, I'm telling you.
My thing off.
Tell you, it's
but,
a tough group.
I speak loudly enough. So, I would like to speak about this case. And I've seen that debate going on by Deep and others
including when I was a Clark County Planning Commissioner, that used to come up quite often. And of course, one of the rules of the impact piece is that it's only on new development. So if you cannot use those PIFs for deficiencies that already exist. So if you lower those PIFs now, you will have deficiencies in the future because we know we're still developing. City of Vancouver can combine their districts because just about everything within the city limit has been built out. Whereas in the Clark County, it's still developing. But also, by lowering those PIFs, it's a double-edged sword. So please consider that very carefully. I do know that the all abilities parks are necessary. The Light of Neighborhood Association has been advocating for it for over 15 years. And we're finally going to get the first ever all abilities play area in Flyda Park, too. But that should not be a question. That should be a right for everybody, for us to be inclusive. And going back, yes, there were problems. However, going forward, we know that we have a strategic goal to treat everybody equally, proportionally, and fairly. And as we wrote in our newsletter from July, this is something that has been out there, and we really need to recognize the need. And that should be part of the requirement. The ADA requirements do not provide for that. So we should maybe reconsider some of our standards for the parks, not just the new parks, but also past parks. But the new parks should have the priority. By lowering those PIFs, you're not going to be able to do that. Because the soft landing area that is required by the all abilities parks. And you were asking Chris about, you know, if the technology is coming down. Well, unfortunately, the price is set up high, but the benefits are high as well. Because it will allow access to everybody equally. But then also, I'm glad that you had mentioned that he was talking about affordable housing. Unfortunately, the RCW 8202 also gives some exemptions and some credits under the low income affordable housing. So if they have the PIFs reductions, plus they can apply for exemptions. But the key is, what is affordable? $500,000 homes that they're building in quote unquote affordable areas is not affordable. But under that particular RCW section, they have to meet the specific criteria. And that should not be, affordable housing should not be part of consideration for you to lower the PIFs. And this should be a very, very key goal for you guys this year, regardless of what happens with me, but to make it fair and to make it equitable, but also to make sure that they're funding enough for future development. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And Jan Brown, you wanted to speak again?
Yes, I could.
Sure.
And I wrote it all down, so I promise I'll be.
Okay. This has been a good meeting today. Just wanted to let you guys know that. I wanted to mention Columbia Cascade. I am a retired insurance executive, been in the business for 40 years. And I can tell you that I have looked at the timber camps and the Columbia Cascade itself. But one thing, hearing impaired, playground, I used to teach swimming to special ed kids, hearing impaired, sight impaired. and they compensate with other senses. So if a child is hearing impaired, their other senses are enhanced. So seeing things that are different, even though they can't hear the music or the wind in the trees, they're still going to benefit from something that is so visually unique. They're going to see other people or kids playing on it, and they're going to pick up and create their own games. Youngsters or people that are visually impaired, that's where the sound comes in. That's where the tech. So I applaud where you're going and what you're doing in that effort. And as far as cost goes, I can tell you, I've looked at their account, I mean, this is like 15 years ago, and the cost of reinsurance for playground equipment, because just the liability, is huge, but they happen to have a very good safety record. So that's just my personal knowledge of them as a company. I just want to get that in there. Daybreak, my favorite subject. The overlooks. My concern, because I've been out there several times whacking weeds, doing that kind of stuff, it's where the river undercuts the bank. And I'm afraid that the way that the placement is on some of those overlooks might be washed out, like a jetty or something like that. So I hope you engineers can take a look at that. Also, the parking for horse trailers in the future. I can guarantee you that entrance coming into the boat ramp, if you've got a truck and a trailer with a four-horse trailer and you have to make that cut, you're not going to make it. Instead, you're going to scrape up and break stuff. So that's something that needs to be... And we'd love to be part of the conversation of this and say, hey, this will work or that won't work without, you know, tearing up things in the meantime. Also, the timing of that open house, how can we be notified? That was the other thing that the gal, you. I mean, I live off Padma 94. Among all the speeding truckers and contractors, yada, yada, the people who were commenting about that, how can we be notified of that open house, or is it going to be something that's part of this?
It'll be an outreach process, so the website will be updated with that information, and then also there will be mailers sent out.
Okay, what website? The parks?
The website that is the Lower Bay Break on the Park County website.
Okay, I know that one. Okay, great.
Is there typically a mailing within a half mile proposed for the open house?
There is, but
from farther, yes.
Yeah.
So we had to consider the audience and outreach would be designed
around that. Okay, great. Thank you. I appreciate that. And the timing of an open house is 60 days?
Yeah, we're looking at the end of August.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And I would also say, just know that the Executive Force Council has been very interested.
Yes.
And so we will make sure that you're included.
Outreach
as we move forward with the project. We've been trying to be very conscious of that.
Oh, okay, great. And this is kind of an aside, but we're aware that we have a little bit of a, I'm going to call it headbutting, between Clark County and Stables within the county. And I'm not going to, that's not, I just want to make sure that the facility, the equestrian facility at Daybreak Park, if the county is successful in running out other facilities where there are horse shows or WASET or 4-H, that Daybreak Park then becomes your destination equestrian facility, and that's where the parking could be for the horse trailers, and you can charge. People will pay to park their trailers there. They'll pay to use the arena. They'll pay to use a trail course if it's there. They'll pay to walk, take their horse around the loop. I mean, if you're looking for a way for it to pay for itself, it can be done. So I just wanted to make sure that I covered that. And then the Phelps property, I can guarantee you that depending on the topography, I don't know if it's up and down and hilly and all that, dogs off leash, people will want to take their dogs there because they take their dogs off leash to Daybreak Park. The last time I was there whacking weeds on one of the trails, I had like 9 dogs just coming at me. Well, it was the guy with his hunting dogs, and they were all well trained and all that, but it scared me because I was closer down by the river and all these dogs just kind of came at me. So I just I think don't poo-poo that dog park idea, because people with dogs will go find a good place to take them, and trees, etc. It gives the dogs a different,
sure,
etc. way to look at it. So I'm past my 3 minutes. Thank you very much. Good meeting today.
Okay, so we're running a little over. We'll go do a round table, and Kelly, we'll start with you.
We got bad news on our arboretum. We had thought we were going to get over $1 million, and the property turned out the counting was wrong, and we're only going to get $500,000. But that's better than poke in the eye. So I guess we do own the property now as a nonprofit, and we'll be working with the city, hopefully in the near future, to bring it into the public arena.
Oh, really? Okay.
Cool. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
I got to get out there because I'm going to talk to Takesh about the Evergreen Trails. I need to go out and see that trail out there.
Come on out.
I know. Maybe I'll call you.
Yeah.
Check that out.
I need to get together with you.
Yeah, that'd be good. So the Parks Foundation has lost their space at City Hall, so we are moving to Camas.
Really?
Yes. We're moving to the Camas Community Center. It's a little far out, but you know what? They were gracious enough to host us, and we're not turning them down. So we'll be out there at the community center, and I'm fine with it. I mean, it is a little far out, but that's, you know, we'll make that work out. And then, if any of you like to golf, golf tournament's coming up, and we'd love
what's
to
the date on the golf tournament?
August 19th. August. So if you want to have a team or sponsor, let me know. Teams, and more teams. You have one at the golf tournament? Ours? Which one is that?
Yeah,
Gaston.
Oh. I just signed up this week.
Yes, you did. Thank you very much. Anyway, so if you'd like to come join us, we'd love to have you. So,
Dave?
I'm good.
Good. Barbara?
I'm good as well.
Yes, you did. Signed it. Thank you.
Just a quick note. Out at the Fort of Camas Washougal, we just got the county historic designation for Parkersville Landing, which, we already had state and national, so but at the same time, that combined with the presentation last week on the mill,
Whipple Creek,
thank you, just brought to mind again some of the historic quality of some of our parks and opportunities that really aren't tapped to get there. The thing with Parkersville, for those of you who don't know, it is the first European settlement in Washington State. Not actually Fort Vancouver was over in Washougal, was where the first settlement was. So it's actually a cool little historic area and something we could
it's Camas, right at the port.
East, yeah.
It is a neat little spot.
It is.
I've explored it.
And I'll be out there now, so there you go.
Kevin?
Nothing else.
The only thing I have is two things. Number one, for those of you on the board, Megan included and updated our roster. So that's the second page in here. It's now got Stacy's information.
Additional corrections.
Great. Give that to Megan. And then this is Megan's last meeting with us for a month or two, we think. We wish her the best.
Absolutely.
And congratulations early. A week early, is that right?
Next Friday.
All right. Okay, with that, we're adjourned. Thanks.